I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Well, tomorrow we'll be talking about today's Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage, while today we want to talk about the fact that yesterday the U.S. Supreme Court voted down a key part of the Voting Rights Act. That's the landmark civil rights law that was passed in 1965. That provision required 9 states and smaller jurisdictions in 7 other states with a history of voting discrimination to get permission or pre-clearance from the federal government or federal court before changing their election laws. Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the 5-4 majority, said the country has changed in the last 50 years and that the Voting Rights Act has, quote, been successful at redressing racial discrimination and integrating the voting process. The court's ruling invalidated the formula that Congress has used over the years, and most recently in 2006, to determine the pre-clearance requirements. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg blasted the court's decision, saying hubris is a fit word for today's demolition of the Voting Rights Act. It's our topic for today's Radio Times. Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Gary May. He's a professor of history at the University of Delaware, author of a new book called Bending Toward Justice, The Voting Rights Act and the Transformation of American Democracy. And Gary May, it's been about 8 years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you again.
And on the telephone is Heather Gerken. She's a professor of law at Yale Law School, specializes in election law and constitutional law. She clerked for Supreme Court Justice David Souter. And Heather Gerken, nice to have you with us today on Radio Times.
It's lovely to be here.
Does this ruling yesterday, and I'm so distracted by what happened today, but nonetheless, I do want to talk about the Voting Rights Act because it is so important. But does this ruling yesterday by the Supreme Court, from your perspective, end the Voting Rights Act?
It ends at least half of it. There are two parts of the Voting Rights Act. One provision is called Section 2, and it covers everyone in the country, and it's a generic non-discrimination provision that requires you to go to court and file a lawsuit, just like you would with any other kind of discrimination case, and that still is left standing. But Section 5, which has really been, in some ways, the crown jewel of the civil rights movement, one of the most effective civil rights provisions we've ever seen, has been knocked down. The Supreme Court left open the possibility that Congress could revive it if it created a new formula for deciding who is covered by it but who isn't. But really, at the end of the day, the likelihood of that happening is very slim. So, they've gutted it, and it's hard to imagine Section 5 coming back.
This gets a bit into the weeds, but I think the weeds are important, Heather. When we look at Congress and the fact that over the years it has voted to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act and use this formula that came out of the 1965 law, what are we talking about? What is included in that formula?
Well, the formula was ingenious, actually, because, legislators don't like particularly to call states or localities racist. And so the formula was a very simple formula. It basically looked to a variety of indicators that suggested that you might have a large black population that was disenfranchised, and later a large Latino population that was disenfranchised. And if that was the case, then you were called a covered jurisdiction. And so by using what looked like on the surface just a very neutral kind of social science measure, in fact, they managed to pull in most of the states that you would expect ought to be covered by the Voting Rights Act, that is most of the Deep South as well as jurisdictions elsewhere. And that formula was so successful that Congress just continued to renew it over and over again without doing new studies. So the data on which Congress was relying were old, which is exactly what led the Supreme Court to invalidate Section 5 yesterday.
And I do want to get you in on the conversation, Gary May, but just one more question to you, Heather Gerken. When Chief Justice John Roberts says, much has changed in the last 50 years when it comes to voting and voting rights, is he correct on that?
Well, he's certainly correct that much has changed. The question is whether it has changed because Section 5 has been placed or not. In some ways, it's a very strange question the Supreme Court posed to the federal government, which is essentially to prove a negative. We don't know what the world would look like without Section 5 in place. And one of my friends often uses a description of it's like saying to a patient who's been on Lipitor for a long time, look, your cholesterol is low, things have changed, we can take you off Lipitor. And the real question going forward is, if Section 5 is removed, will we see a different looking set of jurisdictions?
Let me go to you, Gary May, because you've written a book about the Voting Rights Act and some of this history that was part of the creation of the Voting Rights Act. When we talk about this pre-clearance in these states that had discriminated against people, I'm assuming we're talking about things like poll taxes and other forms of discrimination?
Well, the 1965 Act eliminated the most egregious tests, literacy tests primarily. It also contained a statement of the Congress's belief that poll taxes should be abolished. There was some debate about whether the poll tax could be eliminated by statute or whether it required a constitutional amendment. So they didn't. The act did not eliminate the poll tax, but the Supreme Court later did eliminate it. The problems were designed. The act was designed, as Chief Justice Warren stated, the first time that the 1965 Act came to the Supreme Court in 1966, and of course it was upheld. It was found to be constitutional.
Right.
And the Chief Justice said the act was designed to deal with the most obvious and serious problems in discrimination, but also to deal with the more subtle devices. And to get to the question of how much we've changed, what we've seen just in the last 2 years are the proliferation of what Justice Warren described as subtle devices, voter ID cards, cutting back on the hours which you could vote, eliminating Sunday voting, which was very important for the African-American community. They used to go to church on Sunday and then to the polls. It was called taking your soul to the polls, making it more difficult for the League of Women Voters and other agencies like that to recruit new voters. So all of these indicate that we still have a problem with discrimination in voting.
Well, let me turn back to you, Heather. Do you see, and it's been true here in Pennsylvania, an attempt to have a voter ID law. Do you see some of these voter ID laws as kind of the children of literacy tests?
I don't want to overclaim here, because in some ways, they're motivated by political considerations as much as anything else. So it's clear that they are designed to target Democratic voters, and Democratic voters are often African American. But I think the way to understand it is that they have a disparate effect on African Americans. There's no question about that. And so to equate them with the really the bad old days of deliberate discrimination, I think is too much. That doesn't mean they're not serious and that they don't involve racial discrimination in some instances. But I think they're a different kind of thing. But they are the kind of subtle types of discrimination that the act was designed to target. And it's precisely why Congress put it into place.
And Congress has signed off on this. I mean, the last time I think they approved it was 2006, and Heather, it was bipartisan. It was pretty overwhelming. President Bush at the time, essentially congratulated Congress for reauthorizing the Voting Rights Act.
Yes, I mean, this is really the most, I think, shocking thing from the perspective of someone who believes in the separation of powers. You know, when Congress votes something so unanimously, one would think that that's actually a sign that it's a democratically legitimate decision. Although I will say that the fact it was almost unanimous led one of the justices to question whether we should think it's constitutionally suspect for that reason.
Really?
That is, that we should worry that people were somehow co-opted to the vote, which seems, it's sort of turning the separation of powers upside down, because the whole point of the court exercising caution when it reviews congressional legislation is to defer to the democratic process, because 9 unelected people need to be careful when they second-guess the judgments of the American people.
So was this an activist decision by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, the word activist is often tossed around by both sides for stuff they don't like. I will just say this is it's not consistent with precedent. So the last few years, the Supreme Court has cut back on the ability of Congress to remedy discrimination under the 14th Amendment. And the decisions that it issued, including one called City of Bernie, I think, just can't fairly be read as consistent with the earlier decisions of the Warren Court, which were also reviewing these acts, including the Voting Rights Act, for whether or not they were within Congress's power. And the test that was used under the Warren Court was much more generous to Congress than the test the court currently uses. So, yes, they have been moving precedent in a new direction, and some people call that activist.
Gary May, going back to the creation of the Voting Rights Act, and President Johnson was the president who signed this, and we know how he could muscle his way through the U.S. Congress, but he was able to get bipartisan support for the Voting Rights Act.
He was. I'd like to do a little bit of history, if I may. I mean, the court obviously dealt with the issue at hand, although Justice Ginsburg's quite eloquent dissent went into some of the history here. And it's important to realize the history for a number of reasons. One, to understand why this decision has produced such an emotional reaction in the African-American community. We have to remember that prior to the Voting Rights Act, it was extraordinarily difficult for African Americans in the South to register and vote. My focus in the book was on Alabama and particularly Selma, because that's the city from which the Voting Rights Act came. When Martin Luther King went there in 1965, he said, "We're going to write a voting rights bill in the streets of Selma." In order to register to vote, African Americans would have to go down to the courthouse. They'd have to fill out a three-page application. If they made the slightest error, they would be immediately rejected at that point. Then they would have to take a test and copy and interpret a section of the Alabama State Constitution or the Federal Constitution. Now, what's interesting is that white applicants could simply sit down and write the portion of the Constitution they'd have to interpret. African Americans had to listen to a registrar dictate it to them. And if you look at, the differences between what the whites were asked to interpret and the African Americans, it's incredible. I suspect even a Yale law professor would have had difficulty passing that test. And then if you succeeded in registering, your name and address was published in the local newspaper, opening you up to possible intimidation, economic or physical, by the segregationist community. For me, this book was extraordinary because most of the book is about the creation of the act and the unknown heroes of the movement who risked everything, their jobs, their homes, and very often their lives. And there, again, there's a whole legion of these people.
You know what? Hold on to that thought, only because we're up on a break here. We are talking about the Voting Rights Act. Yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court decision. This reminder, tomorrow we'll be talking about today's decision on same-sex marriage. Talking with Gary May, author of Bending Toward Justice, and Heather Gerken, professor of law at Yale Law School, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll be right back.
The Fleischer Art Memorial supports WHYY and offers individuals an opportunity to explore their creative side this summer. Fleischer has a 115-year tradition of providing art classes for thousands of children and adults from throughout the Delaware Valley. There are workshops in drawing, painting, photography, sculpting, and more, taught by Fleischer's noted faculty. The summer session begins July 8th. Details at 215-922-3456 or fleischer.org.
Only 5 days left until WHYY's fiscal year ends. I'm Marty Moskow-Wayne. As WHYY comes to the end of our fiscal year, think of how your favorite public radio station has made a difference in your life. Now you can make a difference with your pledge of support. Pledge online at WHYY.org. When you call, speak with a volunteer about becoming a sustaining member of WHYY so we can invest more of your support into the programs you love. Visit WHYY.org. And thanks.
This week in This American Life, if you're in the country illegally, Why show up at a Border Patrol station?
What's your job?
To enforce immigration laws. What's it to you?
I'm illegal, too.
Oh, you're illegal?
So you think I should get deported?
I don't know. Why don't you show us some ID?
Why getting arrested was his plan all along. This week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the Voting Rights Act and yesterday's decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. Again, our guests are Heather Gerken, a professor of law at Yale Law School, where she specializes in election and constitutional law. She clerked for former Supreme Court Justice David Souter. And here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Gary May, professor of history at the University of Delaware, author of a book called Bending Toward Justice, The Voting Rights Act and the Transformation of American Democracy. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm kind of toggling back and forth between then and now. Heather Gerken, if I can just put a question to you about the kinds of, I'm thinking about people that are covered under these, or were covered, I guess, under these particular states. And one of the arguments in favor of the court's decision, and it might have even been Chief Justice John Roberts, which is when you look at the numbers of African Americans who are registered to vote and who did vote in last year's presidential election, you look at the fact that we have an African American president, that's an example that from at least the Chief Justice's perspective, and perhaps even from Clarence Thomas as well, Justice Thomas, is that we don't need the Voting Rights Act anymore.
Well, I think that's just the wrong way to think about the question, because, of course, one of the reasons why we are in a world where African Americans are able to vote at such high levels is because they were registered and protected in voting. I mean, the funny thing about the current world is that African Americans are a group that votes in a highly democratic fashion, one of the most consistent democratic voting groups in the country. What that means is that it makes them ripe for discrimination based on their politics. Because, you know, any group that votes at that high level, if you're on the other side, you want to knock them out of the polling place if you can. And both sides are just politically motivated in this sense, but it also makes that group particularly vulnerable. And Section 5 has served as a protection for those groups in covered jurisdictions. One example is the Texas voter ID law was held back by Section 5. Texas wasn't able to put it into place when it asked permission last year from the Justice Department and the District Court to do it. But now Texas announced within 2 hours of the decision that it's going to put that voter ID law into place immediately.
And do you see more states putting voter ID laws into place because of the court's ruling?
Well, we really have seen in the last few years state legislators that are dominated by one party or another trying to use that power to help themselves and hurt their opponents. And a lot of Republican-dominated legislators have been passing voter ID laws for reasons that you can imagine are completely politically motivated but have an adverse effect on African Americans. So Professor May was just discussing the reduction of voting time on Sunday for the Souls to Polls movement. That really makes a difference in a community, and it's not a coincidence that they ended vote on Sunday. It had nothing to do with some kind of worry about administrative issues. They were worried about a group that was highly Democratic.
You want to say something to that, Gary May?
Well, yeah, it's absolutely true. To get back, if I may, to the historical events, Marty has mentioned the role Lyndon Johnson played here, and certainly Johnson, you know, played a major role. But it took a shock to the national system to really bring about the Voting Rights Act. And that shock occurred on March 7th, 1965, on what is now famously known as Bloody Sunday. Demonstrators were planning a march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. They faced a sea of blue, Alabama state troopers, many of them on horseback, armed with bats, wrapped in barbed wire, cattle prods. They attacked the demonstrators savagely, John Lewis, now, of course, a civil rights icon, congressman from Georgia, was struck on the head, and as he fell to the ground, he said to himself, I'm going to die here. Mm. The tear gas sickened and choked many others. The bodies were dropping to the ground. The cruel sheriff of Dallas County, Jim Clark, who had done so many things to King's demonstrators when they arrived there in January in 1965. He was orchestrating things, and someone cried out, call an ambulance, and Clark replied, let the buzzards eat them. Among the,
and this was a sheriff talking.
Yes. Among the people on the bridge that day was a little girl, 8-year-old girl, Cheyenne Webb, who, when she ran home, was crying, not because she'd been injured, but because she said, she later wrote that she felt like she had been a slave beaten by her master. And when she went to the next demonstration, she left a note for her parents in the form of an obituary, describing herself as 8-year-old Cheyenne Webb at the Culver School. Cheyenne wants people to be happy and free. This shocked the country.
Do you think this decision will shock the country
I think
similarly?
So. Well, you know, obviously it's not exactly analogous, but seeing the footage of that attack that Sunday evening on ABC News, the country was very angry, and thousands of people joined King and Selma. Others besieged Lyndon Johnson, who was forced to move up a voting rights bill to the top of his legislative agenda. And not long after that, he presented it to the Congress, gave his famous speech, perhaps the greatest of his presidency, in which he invoked the anthem of the civil rights movement, saying, "And we shall overcome." And it's my sense, perhaps, that yesterday's decision will have a similar impact, that it will re-energize the voting rights and civil rights movements.
Do you feel similarly, Heather?
I hate to be more cynical about it, I think that so here's the core question that Chief Justice Roberts presented, which is whether the South has changed.
Right.
And we're all debating this question about where we are in history, and since we don't conveniently have a parallel universe to run the experiment, and we can't see what the South would look like in a world without Section 5. I think, I just to put my lawyer's hat on for a moment, I mean, the way I look at this opinion is that, to me, there's all kinds of forms of discrimination that can take place, and some of them on the big-ticket items, like in redistricting, where you worry, and other issues where there are political parties coming in who will protect their own constituencies. I don't so much worry about the absence of Section 5, because I think that lawsuits can take care of that, even if they're slower. But where I worry about Section 5 is the little things. Nothing nearly as dramatic as what happened on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, but these sort of small efforts to discriminate, to make it harder for one group or another to vote, that take place at the state and local level, and they're too small to have for a lawsuit. It takes too long. It costs too much money. Nobody has the resources to bring lawsuits for all those cases. And it's those little things that in the aggregate can really matter, that Section 5 really mattered for, and the Department of Justice really mattered for. Because just to go back to build a little bit on Professor May's history, the magic of Section 5 was that it solved the problem that the law could not at that point solve. Because there were Justice Department lawyers and civil rights lawyers going into court trying to help get blacks registered under the circumstances that Professor May was describing. But every time they would get to the point of succeeding in a lawsuit, The Southern registrars would resign, they'd have to start the lawsuit over, they'd flip to a different form of discrimination, and so they were just playing whack-a-mole, essentially, with these suits. They couldn't get any traction, and the magic of Section 5 was that it shifted the burden of inertia, and it required these discriminatory jurisdictions to ask permission first before they put the legislation into place, and that was incredibly unusual and incredibly imaginative, and that's what we've lost, is the ability for that kind of protective weapon to be in place to protect the rights of Latino and Black voters in this country and other voters of color.
And that's Heather Gerken, who joins us along with Gary May. We are talking about yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the Voting Rights Act. And again, Heather Gerken, professor of law at Yale Law School, Gary May, professor of history at the University of Delaware, author of a new book called Bending Toward Justice, the Voting Rights Act and the Transformation of American Democracy. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'd like to get both of your reaction to something that Justice Scalia had said earlier this year about voting rights and perhaps even this Section 4, Section 5 we've been talking about, Heather, seeing this as a perpetuation of, quote, racial entitlement. He saw the Voting Rights Act as a form of racial entitlement. And I'd be curious about your response to that.
Well, this makes me a little bit crazy, actually. So what he's talking about, I think, probably to give Justice Scalia the most generous read on his comments, was probably not the protections against discrimination at the polling place. What he was talking about, I suspect, was redistricting. And there are some folks who look at redistricting and see deliberate efforts required by the Voting Rights Act to create what are called majority-minority districts. These are districts with a majority of African Americans or Latinos that are capable of electing the candidate of choice for those voters. And they think of that as some sort of form of affirmative action. I find this really nothing short of bizarre for two reasons. So the first is the reason why they create these districts is because whites and blacks or whites and Latinos are voting in what's called a racially polarized fashion, which basically means they're voting against each other's candidates. So without a majority black or majority Latino district, you will not be able to elect the candidate of choice of that group. Everyone else, you know, in every other district, as long as there's no one discriminating against their candidates, can pull, haul, and trade, to use Justice Souter's phrase, and get their candidates elected and, you know, be winners and losers in the usual course of politics. But when someone is always voting against your candidate of choice, you will never get your candidate of choice. So I understand these districts as giving black and Latino voters the same thing that white voters routinely enjoy but don't even notice, which is the chance to vote for a winner, the chance to vote for their candidate of choice. And what's so strange about Justice Scalia's statement that this is somehow beneficial to a gimme or affirmative action of some sort is we have white majority districts all across the country, and those are never seen as affirmative action of any sort, even though they do exactly the same thing, which is give a certain set of voters the chance to elect their candidate of choice.
How do you see it, Gary May?
Well, I too was shocked by Scalia's remark. I share Heather's lunacy here. We can get a room together in some psychiatric facility. I don't think we'd be alone. I criticized the decision, or rather his speech and characterization in a Washington Post op-ed, pointing out that one of his statements said that the Voting Rights Act had done nothing for white people. And I noted that, again, from the book I've written, that the first election that was held after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, especially, again, in Alabama, while there was a huge turnout from newly registered African Americans, there was an even larger turnout among whites, especially those who were freed of the poll tax. Now, traditionally, of course, it'd be easier for a white person to get registered. But I guess there was a sizable number of poor whites who felt ashamed of not being able to pay the poll tax. So the Voting Rights Act helped white people as well as African Americans.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. We have, looks like, Robert from Wilmington, Delaware. Robert, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. My feeling is that the decision that they made yesterday was really to deal with Hispanic votes in the future. And that I'm concerned that that's what the vote was yesterday. They're concerned at how they can control Hispanic votes in the future, not as much as dealing with black votes.
Robert, let me...
I'd like the answer from...
Me too. No, I'd like to hear from both our guests. And Gary May, I'd be curious about what you say, and then to you, Heather Gerken.
Well, what's fascinating is that the country is evolving into a much greater multi-ethnic, multi-racial society. I read a study the other day that indicates that perhaps in 10 years, Mississippi and Georgia may become majority-minority states. So He's quite correct. They're a Hispanic community, Asian American community, need the protection of Section 5, because I don't think the developing white minority now in America is going to go gently into that good night. They are going to resist and have resisted these developments. Instead of courting these new voters, they're trying to suppress their political activity.
Do you see demographics changing voting rights or even the Voting Rights Act, Heather Gergen?
Yeah, in response to Robert's comment, I think I'd separate it out two things. So will it have an effect on Latino voters by the invalidation of Section 5? I think the answer is clearly yes. They've been what we've always called the sleeping giant of American politics for a long time. There was a question about how the group would vote and what rate it would vote. But it's obviously become a major player in American politics and will continue to do so, and particularly if it ends up taking a voting pattern along the lines of African Americans voting for one party or another, that'll make that group more vulnerable to the kinds of activities that that we've seen so far directed against African American and poor voters. As to whether that's the court's motivation, I really don't think so. I mean, these are people of principle. They have principles that are quite different from mine, but they understand themselves as doing something quite different. And you know, I think that it's important to give the most generous read of their motives as we can, so they understand themselves to be policing what they think is flabby and unthoughtful efforts by Congress to do something that's a feel-good thing that they shouldn't have done because they weren't thinking clearly about it. And they think that the South has changed and that ought to be recognized, and that Congress's failure to do so is an abrogation of its duties. And, I don't think that's right, but I do think that their motivation is a motivation that's undergirded by principle rather than the kind of political motives that were just attributed to them.
And I do want to pick up on that. Let me get, though, Jean from Mount Airy to join us on Radio Times. And, Jean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I was wondering, I haven't had a chance to read this opinion yet, but how did Section 5, I mean, I understand Section 5 required pre-clearance for certain areas in the South.
Right.
But what about protecting voting rights everywhere else? Because that's certainly not the only place there have been issues. And I'm wondering if maybe this change could shift the focus, because I'm sure there are still ongoing problems with the South, voting rights, but there are also many other places.
Well, Gina,
how was that addressed before, and how will it change now?
Gary May, and do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, there is a part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, which could deal with voting problems in states that are not covered by the Voting Rights Act. But as Heather pointed out, it's much more difficult using Section 2 because the burden of proof is on the person who makes the challenge. Unlike Section 5, it allows these changes to go into effect, and the litigation is expensive, and she's quite right about noting the problems for rural and poor black communities in Pennsylvania as well as Alabama. They're not going to have the resources to mount these challenges, which are going to take a long, long time. So it's a serious problem.
Gene, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Heather, you might want to weigh in on this, but first, a very short break. Then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision yesterday on the Voting Rights Act. This note, we know what happened this morning, and we'll be talking about that tomorrow on Radio Times. Nonetheless, just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talking with Heather Gergen and Gary May. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Lodge Lane Assisted Living supports WHYY. Lodge Lane is now accepting reservations for their new facility located near Wilmington, Delaware. Guided by time-honored Jewish traditions and values, Lodge Lane welcomes residents of all faiths in a supportive, friendly environment with round-the-clock staffing to assist with daily tasks. Featuring a variety of floor plans and amenities that include kosher and non-kosher dining and a secure memory wing, More at 302-764-7000 or lodgelane.org. On the next Fresh Air, why the Lyme disease infection rate is growing, and so is the battle over how to treat it. We talk with Michael Spector about his article, The Lyme Wars, in the current edition of The New Yorker. He'll also tell us what's recommended if you find a tick on your body or your child's that might be carrying Lyme. Join us. This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, the Supreme Court rules on gay marriage. Also, a Holocaust survivor remembers his trip on a Kinder transport to America.
It was obviously emotionally upsetting to me and to my brother, Joe, who was 8 at the time. And I, being the 6-year-old, was the worst of the two of us.
Next time on Here and Now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Gary May from the University of Delaware, author of Bending Toward Justice, and Heather Gerken, a law professor at Yale University, talking about yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court ruling involving the Voting Rights Act and this issue of preclearance. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Heather, even picking up on what Gene was saying right before the break, one of the critiques, I think, is that either the Voting Rights Act should be applied to the whole country or should be applied not at all. I wonder what you make of that.
Yeah, I mean, Gene is absolutely right, and I think everyone has long known that the coverage formula was both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. It covered places, which is true of all laws. They always end up including someone you shouldn't and not including someone you should. And I know that every law professor and election law professor in the country has a list of jurisdictions that are not in the Deep South that they'd really think ought to be covered by the Voting Rights Act. Given what the Supreme Court said in its opinion yesterday, though, I think that the only viable option going forward is something that looks like a nationwide coverage akin to Section 2, but I hope would be something with a much easier administrative process. So rather than having to go through an expensive litigation-heavy process in the federal courts, it would be possible through an administrative process to resolve discrimination claims, because I think that's the only hope for addressing the kinds of claims I was talking about earlier, those smaller-scale claims where there isn't a big political party willing to put the money in beside it, where the civil rights groups just don't have enough resources to do all that litigation.
Heather, do you think this particular Congress can deal with this issue?
This particular Congress has had a lot of trouble dealing with many issues that are deeply salient to the American people, and so I'm pretty cynical about Congress's ability to get anything done. That being said, Section 5 is really special. It's somehow that case yesterday felt different to me than many of the recent Supreme Court decisions striking down congressional legislation, because, as Professor May pointed out, this is one of those provisions that people fought and died for, and it really was the crown jewel of the civil rights movement. And so if anything can energize Congress to do something, one would hope it would be that.
And Gary May, you were talking about Bloody Sunday and the activists who were marching and demonstrating for voting rights, but there's a whole interesting story about how this Voting Rights Act was actually written and who wrote it.
Well, this takes us into what the future will mean. Obviously, the Congress has got to deal with this somehow, and the key question is, what are the Republicans going to do? Now, the Republicans used to be proud to be called the party of Lincoln, and what's, again, I found fascinating writing the book was that the 1965 Voting Rights Act was written in the office of Republican Minority Leader Senator Everett McKinley Dirksen, who became a co-sponsor of the bill, defended the bill on the floor of the Senate. Similarly, in 1982, when the bill came up for reauthorization, it had a problem. It was stuck in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Who broke the logjam? Bob Dole, Republican senator of Kansas. So is the Republican Party of today the party of Bob Dole and Everett Dirksen? I think not, as Bob Dole himself has pointed out. But I guess I'm a bit more optimistic than Heather, because what are the Republicans going to do? Are they going to obstruct a revision of the formula, or the creation, as Heather's noted, of some administrative operation, that, it would seem to me, would be political suicide. Now, I suppose some among the Tea Party would prefer going down with the ship rather than saving it and rebuilding it. But, you know, your normal everyday politician who simply wants to get reelected, I don't think is about ready to commit suicide.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have someone calling us from Princeton. Can't quite read your first name there. Is it Mac?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, Mac. You're on Radio Times.
I'm a student at the University of South Carolina. I'm about 21. I just want to say that the South, the new generation, is a lot more progressive than it used to be, and people have changed their outlook. I mean, the rest of America kind of looks at the South as this discriminatory society against minorities where people still believe in segregation. It's quite wrong. I mean, the old generation might believe that, but the new generation has a much more accepting personality, and the attitude that is one step held no longer exists. So I think that there's no reason for this section to exist because people aren't discriminatory like they used to be. Maybe 5% of the people that I ever met living here actually discriminate or think people are less than they are because of their race or minority.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, Mac, and I want to see what – let me start with you, Gary May.
Well, I'm happy to
Different
hear
South.
That. I think things are changing in the South, demography is destiny. More African Americans are returning to the South. The Hispanic community is moving there as well. But we're still going to need these protections.
Heather, I'd be curious about your response to Mac's comments.
Yeah, so I think that in some ways I take Mac's comments very seriously, and they're certainly reflected in a variety of studies. What I would just say is this, is that to me we worry about discrimination of two kinds. One is the intentional discrimination, which is what Mac was talking about, right, which is the old school, I'm not going to vote for that person because he's black, and discrimination of that kind of blatant sort. And he's absolutely right that's we just don't see the kinds of examples that we had even in the 1980s in this kind of context. But there's a second way in which discrimination can happen, and it happens in some ways, it's a vestige of past discrimination, but it happens when people pass a law that has what we call a disparate effect. So it may not be that the intent was to hurt the group, but they end up hurting the group. And what makes the South particularly vulnerable to some kinds of disparate effect claims is that they have a very large African-American population that votes very heavily Democratic. And that makes that population vulnerable because when you have that big a group, they're going to be a target because of their voting patterns. It also happens when you see a burgeoning population, usually a new immigrant population. So we see this kind of discrimination of the effect sort taking place in places where Asian and Latino communities are coming in and growing very quickly and upsetting the political status quo. And sometimes it's implicit discrimination and sometimes it's underlying bias, but sometimes it's just plain old down and dirty politics. But down and dirty politics can still have an effect on minority voters, a quite substantial effect on minority voters. And Section 5 was designed to protect against that. Whenever the Justice Department would deny preclearance, it was never saying, or almost never saying, that something was intentionally discriminatory. What they were just saying is this has an effect on a group of voters that we think is particularly vulnerable. Whatever your purpose was, we're not making a judgment about that. We can see it having this effect. And when it has this effect, our job is to protect that group. And that's what Section 5 did. So I think that I completely take Mac's point and the feeling that this is, you know, targeting a group of people who don't deserve to be targeted as racist. But that's not the way the law works. The law works, it's just about effects. And I will just say, I'm from New England. Part of the reason that you don't see as many claims here is because we don't have as large black populations and Latino populations concentrated in the way they are in the South. But where you see it, you start to see these disparate effects happening. So I this is why I'm happy to have a national coverage formula, because I think what I just described, the problem of these to groups that are vulnerable, you see it happening all over the country. And so it would be good for them to have the same protections that Section 5 has long bestowed upon Southern minorities.
Well, because I don't think the South has a lock on down and dirty politics. Gary May,
no, it turns out it goes everywhere.
It does. Go ahead, Gary May.
Part of the genius of Section 5, as Heather has noted, is that it had a wonderfully deterrent effect. If a jurisdiction submitted something to the Justice Department, and discussions would go on, and often those effects that would be discriminatory were readjusted. It's also important to point out that the Voting Rights Act had what was called a bailout provision. If a state or a jurisdiction could indicate that for 10 years they had a clear record, they could come out from coverage. What's so shocking really about Shelby County bringing this suit is that within Shelby County there's a city named Calera, and in 2006 or perhaps it was 2008, they decided to revise their voting boundaries with the effect that it eliminated the single black city commissioner on the city commission. And the Justice Department said, you can't do this. They went ahead and did it anyway. And, of course, the black member lost. Justice Department said, you got to rehold the election. You got to revise your districts. They did, and he was returned to his seat. So this was the part of Shelby County, which is attacking the Voting Rights Act.
Mac, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Heather, let me quote something from Chief Justice John Roberts. He said this before writing yesterday's opinion. He said, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discrimination on the basis of race. And there's some truth to that. But do you think he was tipping his hand about this ruling that he wrote?
Well, Chief Justice Roberts has been tipping his hand about this ruling since he was a Justice Department lawyer in the 1980s.
Okay.
So I remember vividly during his confirmation hearing reading the memos. I was working with someone on the Senate, reading memos that he wrote as a young staffer about voting and discrimination issues. And he's always had a view, which goes under the rubric in law of the colorblindness principle, that the best way to stop discriminating against people on the basis of race was not to classify them on the basis of race. And when he wrote those memos in the early 1980s, what he was writing was so far from where the law was that in some ways they were a little bit surprising, maybe even shocking. But I will just say that Chief Justice Roberts has now made those positions the law. He, along with a lot of other judges and lawyers and activists, have pushed very hard to move the law in that direction, and they've won that fight.
Let me get Dorsey from Newcastle, Delaware, to join us. Dorsey, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I think this decision shows that it's time for the Supreme Court to have time limits. For serving. I think, you know, power cannot be held indefinitely without corrupting most people. And some of these justices have become so arrogant and have taken on powers that they really shouldn't have. And there have been a number of examples of this. The first one was the 2000 election. They shouldn't have gotten in it at all. And this is just the final one.
Well, Dorsey, let me see what Gary May says. Are you in agreement with Dorsey?
Well, you know, altering the Constitution is difficult, but I do share her view somewhat. I thought here are these five men, privileged men, graduates of the best law schools in the country, served as U.S. attorneys, judges, in Clarence Thomas's case, an administrator. How do they understand the world of those people who fought and died to bring about the Voting Rights Act? So I'd be interested in knowing what Heather thinks about term limits.
Yeah, do you think that would bring any humility, to use Dorsey's example?
So I worry less about how long they've served than how distant they are. So I think that Professor May puts his finger on it when he says that in many ways they are distant from the concerns of average Americans, and some of them really work hard to compensate for that fact and to think about those questions, and some of them don't. The other, I think, real issue is that for many years we had what you might call a politician on the court. So, you know, Chief Justice Warren was a great politician. I will say Justice Brennan was the finest legal politician I've ever known. Mm. But they had a sort of savviness about politics and an understanding of the way the process worked. Justice O'Connor, I've always thought, is one of the finest politicians in American politics. I mean, she always had a sense for where the middle of the country was, and she was able to craft compromises that sort of roughly stood in for where the American people were on a variety of really tough and hot-button issues. And there really isn't anyone like that anymore at the court. Elena Kagan is a very savvy politician. Many of them have served in various administrations, but they don't have the kind of sort of bona fides that earlier justices have had and the kinds of experiences that earlier justices have had.
We're almost out of time here, but Gary May, we're talking about the Voting Rights Act and what the Supreme Court did yesterday, and yet we know from, in fact, a primary here in Pennsylvania, I think 10% of voters went to the polls to vote.
Well,
the sort of disconnect between this right to vote and the act of voting.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're referring to an off-year
I am,
election,
and a primary.
A primary. I mean, those traditionally attract fewer voters than do elections for governor or senator and certainly a presidential election. All of us tend not to appreciate the importance of voting. But I must just add, I had a student about a year ago in a small seminar, an African-American student who admitted a month before the presidential election in 2012, he had not registered to vote. And I was really troubled. I didn't want to embarrass him in class, but I just felt so sad for him that he didn't understand all it took to bring this about.
Heather, I'm going to give you the last 30 seconds, your final thoughts.
Well, so I do feel like as we're rushing off now to talk about the same-sex marriage cases and everything else, I think it's just worth spending a little time reflecting on what a big decision this was. We've sort of treated it, I think, typically as what do we do next? What is Congress going to do? What does the opinion mean? But this was something that was really important, and we shouldn't let the old girl slip off the headlines for the last time without giving her her due, because it was really an extraordinary moment in our history and an extraordinary moment in the law. And whatever you think about the merits of the Supreme Court's opinion, what happened yesterday was a really big deal.
Well, that's why we wanted to do the show, and frankly, that's why we invited both of you to join us today in Radio Times. Heather Gricken, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And she's a professor of law at Yale Law School. Gary May, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And he's a professor of history at the University of Delaware, author of a new book called Bending Toward Justice. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out about podcasts, Facebook, Twitter, archives, email, information about how to find us on satellite radio. Jessica Crocker, our intern today, Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Bilder with Sophie Reed. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for those phone calls as well.